Welcome to the Hockey Strength Podcast, the official podcast of the world's best resource for hockey strength and conditioning information. HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode number 91 of the Hockey Strength Podcast, the official podcast of HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com. Today's guest is Joel Jackson. Joel resides in Edmonton, Alberta, home of one of the two NHL playoff bubbles, with his wife, Alicia, and two-year-old son, Bodie. He is a strength and conditioning coach at the University of Alberta, where he works with men's hockey, women's hockey, varsity wrestling, and varsity swimming. He completed his Master's of Exercise Physiology in 2015, where his thesis research was on time motion analysis and heart rate response in university hockey. Prior to coming to Edmonton, Joel attended Augustana University in Camrose, Alberta, earning his Bachelor of Science degree and playing for the Augustana Viking men's hockey team for five seasons. He's also part owner of an athlete testing and development company called Competitive Thread, which we talk a bit about today, where he and his partners do on-ice testing and skill development with a number of organizations in the Edmonton area and throughout Alberta and British Columbia. In today's episode, Joel and I talk about on-ice sprint testing and other on-ice testing measures. We talk about how to be creative and how to think about programming for an upcoming season with lots of uncertainties, lots of moving parts, lots of changes in policy by the week. This is a really fun episode, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. So without further ado, here is Joel Jackson. Joel, welcome to the Hockey Strength Podcast. How are you?
Very good. Very good. Thanks for having me on, David. I really appreciate the opportunity and appreciate all the good stuff that you're doing with the website now, really rejuvenating it. So
thank you. I appreciate that. I want to start with We're going to start off topic again today. Tell me the first album that got you into pop punk emo music.
Oh, it would have to be Blink-182 Dude Ranch. Ooh. You know, the album with Damned on it.
Yep.
That was the one. That was definitely the one that made me fall in love with that genre of music for sure.
How did it end up in your hands? I'm sure at that time it was a physical CD.
Yeah, that was a purchase. I this might be a little bit before your time, but I'm sure a lot of people listening will remember it as the Columbia House. I don't know. It was like a record club where you could get like 12 or 14 CDs free if you signed up for, you know, a year or something like that. So, you know, everybody would try to convince their parents to let them do it. And you could, you know, go on and they used to give you these little, it was like a postage stamp, and it was the cover of the album, and you would place it down on a card, whatever, you know, 14 CDs that you wanted. And that's how Dude Ranch came to my house.
Very nice. Okay. Favorite song off Dude Ranch besides Damn It and Josie and Pathetic, something that's not a single?
Apple Shampoo.
It's a good one.
Yeah, definitely.
I'd go with Waggy. I'm a big fan of Waggy. I think that's a super slept on Blink song.
Yeah, that, you know, honestly, that whole album, that's a front to backer, man. Like the whole thing's good. So there's a lot of good options on there.
Yeah, it's a greedy album. It's right before they started to get more polished and stuff. Who else are your favorite, like some five other favorite bands in the genre?
I'd have to go with NoFX, Rancid, Melancholin, and then to just put in a couple more newer age ones, Story So Far and the Menzingers.
Love that. A lot of old school pop punk. I'm also a huge The Story So Far fan, so great new up and coming pop punk band for those interested. But enough of indulging my music tastes, but I'm glad I'm sure a lot of people in hockey, like, it's kind of our genre. I remember, like, I played NHL Hits 2002 on my PlayStation 2, and the song that came on was Rollin' by Limp Bizkit, and that was the moment I was like, yes, this is my genre of music. Anyways, moving on. So why don't you start by sharing the story of the first weight room you ever built?
Okay, yeah. So, I'm in Edmonton, Alberta right now, and I've been here for about 8 years now, but I'm originally from a small town in northern Manitoba, Canada called Snow Lake. I'm sure there's going to be a few Canadian listeners on here. So, you know, to give people a relation, they know where Winnipeg is, I'm sure. So I'm about 7.5 hours drive north of Winnipeg. So I'm way up in the middle of the bush up there. It's a town of about 1,000 people, 800 to 1,000 people, so very small. And yeah, in terms of a weight room, when I was growing up and kind of, you know, getting into the bantam midget age hockey where I was really, you know, starting to train and work out, we didn't have much. So basically what ended up doing is that there was an empty kind of unused classroom at the school that we were allowed to start training in. So what we kind of did is, you know, grab stuff from home that our, you know, our dads weren't using anymore, and then kind of just put the call out to people in the community if they had any sort of equipment, if they would be willing to donate it to us. So, you know, I wish I had more pictures of this place, because it was all that old vinyl weeder weight and like the really small diameter bars, and it was pretty gritty, but you know, we kind of had enough in there to make it work. And you know, one of my favorite memories from it is that we didn't have anything to squat with, so you know, it was just strictly kind of benches and dumbbells and a few barbells, and my dad ended up making us a squat rack out of just 2x6s and, you know, bolted it into the ground and onto the wall. And kind of what you were talking about before, I think some of the homemade gym equipment's really caught on in the last few months with the shutdown, but I have a feeling that that might've been one of the original homemade squat racks. And, you know, it served its purpose for sure. We definitely used it a lot. And yeah, so, you know, did a lots of work in that small space to kind of make it usable enough for us. And they ended up, you know, getting a little bit more government grants to spice it up a little bit. And they painted it and put some rubber flooring in it and, you know, made it a little bit more acceptable of a gym space for people in the public to use. And then my, you know, one of my biggest claims to fame is that the teacher that kind of got that grant and put everything together, he ended up naming it after me. So it's the Joel Jackson Community Weight Room. So yeah, that's definitely one of my, if we ever have any icebreaker things when I was teaching classes and you have to do the two truths and one lie, I would usually throw that one in there to try to throw people off a little bit.
I love that. The reason I wanted to start with that story is because that's going to be a theme of this episode and probably of, as strength coaches, our lives for the next probably hockey season, honestly. And that theme is making it work with what we have. So why don't you explain what's going on in your situation up in Alberta right now?
Yeah, so basically, you know, we're kind of in a similar situation to a lot of people, but it recently kind of changed for the worse, I guess. But about 2 months ago, the two teams that I take care of here, the two hockey teams that I take care of, like the Pandas are the female team and the Golden Bears are the male team. They play in the Canada West Conference of U Sports here in Canada, which is the university athletics conference. So CanWest announced that they were going to condense the season and have it starting, you know, no sooner than January 1st of 2021. And then a couple of weeks after that, our athletic director at the university made the decision to basically shut down all of our team sports for the entire season. So that included both hockey teams, football, soccer, rugby, volleyball, basketball, everybody. So that, you know, obviously a very tough decision. And that was, you know, based on a number of different things. Obviously COVID had a lot to do with it. And then, you know, we're kind of in a tricky situation in here in Alberta where the big institutions are facing pretty big budget cuts from the provincial government. So won't go into too much detail on that, but it's like, long story short is financially nobody's in that good of shape right now. So tough decision, you know, obviously quite hard on a lot of the athletes really, and tough for them to wrap their head around it. But, you know, basically moving forward, just kind of have to look at it as an opportunity to, you know, get the athletes better, get the hockey players better on the ice and off the ice. So that's kind of how it stands right now in terms of the situation.
And strength coaches, there's so much to think about with this. Of course, we're going to have to throw our programming plan out the window and start from scratch. But we're also going to need to check with our athletes. You know, we're going to need to figure out who's coming into a gym, who has access to what equipment. So what's the first thing that you're now taking action on, given this news, to help out with your athletes?
So I guess like, the one of the biggest things for me during the shutdown was just to keep a pretty constant line of communication going with all my athletes and, you know, basically making sure their programs are individualized to the sense of what they do have available for them. And I'm still continuing to have to do that. There is a lot more people that are open access to gyms right now, but, you know, as it looks right now, most courses are going to be online, but there still will be a lot of in-person stuff in smaller cohorts for classes that have like labs and things like that. So that's basically going to mean that, most, if not all the athletes will still be here training full time come the fall. So that's obviously like a big plus right off the bat. I would say the biggest thing currently right now is what I'm trying to do is communicate with our coaching staffs for both teams and just try to get them aware of like my mindset in terms of like how I'm planning and structuring their workouts and then trying to do my best to help the practices complement or have them complement each other, I guess. So
a clarification question, will the teams still be practicing on the ice?
Yes. Yeah. So, as far as we know right now, in terms of like the restrictions in place currently, and as we all know, everything kind of changes pretty consistently in terms of if cases shoot up or anything like that. But, in our gym space right now, we're allowed to have 50 people. It is about a 10,000 square foot space. So it is pretty large, and that number is the same for on ice. So you can have 50 people, and that's obviously including players and coaches, but as of right now, ices are opening up and players are getting on the ice for sessions and things like that. So in terms of practices, it should hopefully be, I'm going to say status quo. It's not going to be 100% normal, but they should be able to run a pretty good structured practice in terms of their scheduling there.
How are you thinking about your programming? Are you even planning out months ahead? Are you taking it month by month? How are you thinking about that?
So right now, the biggest thing that I'm doing is, talking to the coaches and just trying to make sure that they understand that, with there being no games and no competition, that can't mean that the athletes just get pushed as hard as possible every single day. By no means, I don't think that coaches will kind of jump right on board and start doing that, but I'm just trying to get, a plan in place, just more really looking at the microcycle or their week and then trying to pitch the idea of them following like a pretty consistent mesocycle focus too, in terms of like a 4-week phase. So what I've kind of pitched to them is a high-low model, kind of borrowing a lot of periodization ideas from track and field there. So what I would like to see, ideally moving forward to come the fall, is that Monday, Wednesday, and Friday be their kind of hard days, their push days. So being on the ice all three of those days with, a fairly high intensity practice and hopefully more of the higher volume push towards the end of the week. And then also have their lifts on those days as well. So have them lifting on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And then on Tuesdays and Thursdays, they wouldn't be in the weight room. And then if there was any sort of on ice, it would be, very low intensity, skill focused work. Obviously that's not something that's written in stone, especially because I think they still will have opportunities to have some competition, probably not in the immediate future, like first thing in the fall, but when we transition into the new year, there are a couple other universities and colleges in the Edmonton area that have men's hockey teams that they could potentially set up exhibition games with, and same thing on the female side. So I'm kind of, pitching that to them in terms of, keep the high days high and the low days low. So you're not kind of spreading everything out throughout the week and just end up flatlining the training stimulus. So that's something that I've pitched before during just normal times when we have bye weeks and things like that. And the coaches have seemed to get behind it pretty good. So I think I have a pretty good foothold there already. And then in terms of the mesocycle or like a 4-week phase, I'm just trying to push of like that build, crash, recover kind of model where, we start them off in week one, just to kind of give like a little bit of a frequency setting. I would say like a 3 to 4 ice sessions in week one, 2 gym sessions, and then week 2, bump it up to 4 to 5 ice sessions, 3 gym sessions, 5 to 6 ice sessions in week 3 gym sessions. And then in the deload week or that fourth week, kind of dropping things down, maybe 2 ice sessions, 1 maybe team builder, and then maybe 1 to 2 gym sessions to kind of like taper it off, let them kind of realize the benefits of their training, and then start back up on the next 4-week phase.
I want to underscore a couple of things there. Number one, I think it's really smart that you're only moving in 4-week blocks. Like we did not expect to be here in July, back in May, let alone in February. And so I think trying to plan out a 16-week phase is like, I don't know, let me know how it goes, but I can't imagine like you're going to get past like week 7 or 8 before things change.
No, I totally agree. And typically, you know, the way like I'm programming just normally, like throughout their off seasons and things like that, like I'm pretty strictly just planning like the 4 weeks ahead, right? Like I know what their next phase is going to be. And then, you know, it's going to leave me some freedom and some wiggle room to adjust things if I need. But, you know, I think during the fall and winter semesters that coaches looking at their practice plans from a 4-week standpoint is something that could be a really effective strategy for them in terms of like, you know, trying to realize some benefits out of the training. And, you know, another thing that I'm trying to push is just some focused on ice conditioning in each one of those Monday, Wednesday, Fridays as well. You know, and the idea there would be to, you know, have some structured speed focused trainings earlier in the week. Middle of the week would probably be more focused on repeated sprint type of work where, you know, they are doing short sprints separated by short amounts or shorter amounts of rest, and then having like more of an aerobic focus with their on ice conditioning on that last day of the week where it ends up being that, you know, that high volume day, so they can go into the weekend and have, you know, 1 to 2 days off to recover from it. And, you know, I've talked with other strength and conditioning coaches about this before and hockey coaches as well. And what I usually try to follow with that, you know, microstructure cycle or like the structure of a week is that fit fatigue model. And I know I'm sure most coaches or a lot of coaches have heard it before or, you know, read about it in many ways. And there's actually a researcher at our university here at the U of A that wrote a very good article on it that outlines it quite well in terms of, you know, a typical microcycle structure and how you should periodize your power, strength, and high volume days.
Yeah, can you explain? I actually don't know about the fit fatigue model. So could you elaborate a bit more on that?
Yeah, so basically, it's the best way to explain it would be just kind of like a restructuring of that GAS model, the general adaptation syndrome, where just like there for everything that you do, there's a fitness after effect and a fatigue after effect, right? So, you know, a day like, you know, if I had a day in the gym where I was very focused on speed and power, that type of day would have a quite large fitness effect, whereas the fatigue effect would also be quite large immediately, but it would dissipate very quickly, right? So it's the kind of ideas like a power day would be better suited earlier in the week so that the athlete could recover, bounce back. If that was Monday, they would be ready to go for their Wednesday, right? And in many ways, Anthony Donskov's new book, The Game Go Grow, follows this pretty much to a T in terms of like the fit fatigue model, where he has that high volume day at the end of the week. So, and that's the kind of thing where, you know, he goes gain with the strength day, power, volume at the end, and that kind of follows that suit as well. And then with the higher volume work, same thing when you look at the fit after effects and the fatigue after effects, the fatigue after effects of a workout like that are something that they don't dissipate as quickly, and they will, you know, potentially negatively affect any preceding training sessions, right? So it's like best suited to put that work at the end of a microcycle where you know that you do have, you know, up to 72 hours of recovery before you get after it again. So that's a very brief description of it. Again, like if you wanted to put it in the show notes or anything like that, I definitely send you that article, and anybody that hasn't dug into it before can take a look. But it is very good, and it's something that you know, myself and a few other coaches here teach a kind of a fourth year resistance training class at the university, and that's one of the articles that it's one of the cornerstones of like the material that we cover on planning and organization of training. And it's just something that we've kind of made essential in a lot of the things that we do at the gym here.
Yeah, let's definitely put that article in the show notes. I want to bookmark this in case we get to it, so I don't forget that you teach strength conditioning. That is cool. We might get to it. But I want to underscore another important thing that you kind of glossed over a bit is how much you're communicating with your on-ice coaching staff. Like, I think this is super important, especially right now when kids haven't been on the ice and a lot of coaches might be prone to, you know, try to like make up for lost time idea, like skate them pretty hard when really we need to ease into things.
Yeah, definitely. And that's one thing that I'm very, very fortunate here is that I have an excellent relationship with the coaching staffs on the female and the male team, and they're both, you know, amazing at their jobs as well. So like Howie Draper is the coach of the Pandas team, and he's the only coach the program has ever had. So he was the first coach when the program came to be, and he's still going. And that's not to say he's not an old man or anything. You know, if you'll listen to this, you probably think that I'm making him seem old, but yeah, he also does a lot of coaching with the Canadian national team programs as well on the female side. So he has a wealth of experience, and he's always very open to communication with me about, you know, how the structure of practices should look at different times of the year. And, you know, during normal seasons when he has these bye weeks or, you know, different times during, you know, Christmas breaks or things like that, he's always kind of in my ear talking about how things could be structured and what is week's going to look like that. And then on the male side, Ian Herbers is the head coach, and you know, he, again, a ton of experience. Like he worked with the Edmonton Oilers for 3 seasons and was technically just on a leave, and he ended up coming back to the Golden Bears 2 years ago was his first season back. So you know, 2 guys that are very, very well suited for those roles and very smart coaches. So I'm definitely blessed to have that situation where I am as well, with that good relationship with the coaches.
Yeah, that relationship's super important. I'm wondering how that strong relationship formed a lot of your interest in starting to do on-ice speed testing. So why don't you talk about how that started?
Yeah, with the on-ice speed testing, I know it was, I think one of the biggest things is that's always kind of, you know, stuck with me is how they don't have any of it at the NHL combine. You know, that's something that always really still kind of flabbergasts me a little bit. But I think one of the biggest things with the speed testing is when I have like a side company that I'm part owner of, that we purchased a whole bunch of like on ice testing equipment. It would be probably about 7 or 8 years ago now. But that's kind of really how I gained interest in it is kind of through using it as a business opportunity. So, you know, I definitely would have a little bit of a biased opinion toward it on that side, but, I think seeing that and, you know, going out and testing teams is where I really started seeing the value in it. And, you know, for just to give you an example of how we use it here at the U of A, you know, last year we had 1 day of on-ice testing and the second day was their off-ice testing to kind of start their training camp. And what I do when I kind of analyze those scores is I use Z scores. So basically what that allows me to do is weight different tests differently, right? So I can basically look at, you know, say their vertical jump. I want this to be worth 10% of their overall fitness score. Their on ice sprint is going to be worth 15% of their overall score. And I'm just like slotting that out so it adds up to 100%. And then I can basically get a total score for every player and then rank them in terms of where they're falling within the team, within their position, and so on. So when you add the on-ice component into that and you rank the players, there's guys that creep up towards the top that you would never expect to be there. And that's the kind of thing is if we solely looked at their off-ice fitness testing scores, they would probably be somewhere near the bottom. But that really kind of like lets it stand out as like, you know, how quick these guys are on the ice, how agile they are on the ice. And ultimately it comes down to that. That's the most important thing, right? Well, obviously the most important thing is like how many pucks they can put into the back of the net, but you know, that on ice component is huge, right? So you know, you really see different players that you wouldn't expect just from, you know, what you know about them in their off ice kind of conditioning habits and profile that they wouldn't typically kind of come towards the top. But when you add that on ice component in there, it really sheds some new light on it.
How do you use that information to help them improve? I'm like just painting a hypothetical example. So let's say you have a player who has really high vertical jump, but he's got like a 39-inch vertical jump, and he's running like a pretty fast 10-yard sprint off the ice, but he's not that fast on the ice. What does that say to you, and what do you and the coaching staff do with that information?
Yeah, that's a question that I've like often thought about many times as well. And I know, and I can't remember where I heard him say this. I think it might've been at the NSCA's Hockey Strength and Conditioning Conference, but Kevin Neild did a presentation. I think it was probably about 2 years ago now. And he talked about exactly this, where, you know, say if you have a guy that he displays a great deal of power off the ice, but he's maybe fallen towards the middle of the pack in terms of on ice sprint testing, that's probably telling you that that kid or that athlete needs to have a conversation with the skating coach, right? Because it's probably something to do with their skating mechanics that's really holding them back. And then if you kind of flipped it and say you have a guy that's kind of flirting with the top of his peer group in terms of his speed on the ice, but those power numbers are pretty low in terms of the rest of them, then it's that's a good example or a good opportunity for you to kind of develop some power off the ice with that athlete, and it'll most likely translate to him kind of inching that on ice speed up a little bit higher, you know, close to the top 5-1% kind of thing.
Yeah, that's why I think it's so important, is it can really help a player identify like what their limiting factor is in their speed, right?
Definitely. Yeah. And then again, we talked about this a little before we came on, but the kind of thing is like a lot of players that, you know, with the Golden Bears guys, with the men's hockey team, like a lot of these guys are, you know, coming off 4 or 5 year WHL careers. Some of them have been drafted into the NHL. They're all very, very good hockey players, but, you know, a very small percentage of them has ever been tested on the ice in terms of their speed. And, you know, the one thing that, you know, will often come up is like coaches might have the perspective of a player that they're thinking, yeah, this guy's slow. You know, he needs to get faster on the ice, but then you get him out there with the lights and you find out, okay, I don't think he's as slow as you thought, right? Like he might look a little slow, right? Like he might not look like the greatest skater, but you know, you need to put some numbers behind these sprints and numbers behind their on ice performance to actually, you know, make a really sound, well-informed decision on it in terms of like plans of action of what you can do to improve that player.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. I want to give a shout out to your company, competitivethread.com. Maybe at some point, if you want to write an article, or I can help you write an article, just like kind of for people who can learn more. But I want to give people an opportunity if they don't have any like fancy technologies. Like, I guess if you have Browers, you could probably take those on the ice and do your speed tests. Like, what low budget suggestions would you have for coaches who want to start testing their athletes on the ice?
Yeah, 100%. Like, you know, the Browers are, you know, they're awesome. And like, that's like what we use, like, or what I use in the gym off the ice. And, you know, like if you have those, then like, go for it. Like they can definitely be put on the ice as well. You know, and like, I guess like the, you know, the, I want to say bottom of the barrel, but like, you know, you hand timing is, it still has value, right? Like we all know that it's not, you know, going to be the most reliable tool, but it is somewhere to start. Right. And, you know, even like on the ice, off the ice, just, you know, giving some numbers to the athletes can definitely just, if anything, increase engagement, increase motivation, which are huge. We all know that, right? And like, I know with like, you know, the thing with the on ice testing is that it could be pretty valuable in a return to play process as well. You know, so if we get these baseline numbers from these guys, and you know, at the start of the season, like we come out with all our fancy lights and test them through everything like that. But it's the kind of thing is like, say if we have a guy that's injured and he's coming back, you know, it's obviously not going to be a concern this year with no competition, but you know, we're going to start playing eventually again. But if you want to see how close he is to his baseline, like it'd be fine for me to just bring the Browers out into the ice for a practice and just have that one player run through a couple sprints just to see where he's at. Right. So it's pretty easy to check in with, right. All you need is a measuring tape and those timing lights, or, you know, a stopwatch if you don't have the Browers, but You know, I think like one of the biggest things is just, you know, figure out what you can do and just start there, right? And just start collecting some data, and it'll just really help your decision-making process.
Yeah, I'll give a few suggestions with the stopwatches. I've used these with like I do a lot of like remote training. And so having the kids basically have to like time themselves. And the only way that really works is if like, you're probably not gonna be able to do a 10-yard sprint, like on or off the ice, because it's just not gonna be as reliable. It's not gonna be as precise or as accurate. My high school chemistry teachers be mad at me right now, but one of those two. So make it a little bit longer, like make the test a little bit longer. Like maybe you should go goal line to blue line, back to goal line, instead of just going to the blue line, because the longer distance will make it a bit more accurate. Any other suggestions along that line if you're just going off stopwatch to make it more valuable?
Yeah, I think you hit it, the nail on the head there, David. Is just like, you know, try to make it so it will complement the validity and the accuracy of it, like as best as possible. So like saying like something super short, you know, probably not going to work that well, but you know, just like a simple stop start could be an excellent test. And like, that's, you know, part of the kind of on ice combine that we do with these players is, you know, just straightaway sprints. So we do them forwards and backwards for a 30 meter distance. And then we have, two different agility type of drills. So the one is just a very simple stop start. So it's a 12 meter distance. They start behind the light, go out, stop, come back. And then the other one is, we call it a transition agility. So it's basically they have to start behind the light up to a top cone that's 12 meters away, pivot backwards around a bottom cone, come up, stop, and then back through. So it's giving them like a little bit of an evaluation of their ability to transition from forwards to backwards skating. Obviously something that's going to be a little bit more important for a defenseman over a forward, but you know, just kind of give you like a complete picture of their kind of on ice ability. And then we also do a bit of a conditioning test. So it's, or I should call it a repeated sprint test. So this one's 7 15 meter sprints. So, you know, for most rinks, that's going to work out to blue line, and they have to repeat that every 15 seconds. So it's like one sprint, coast back to the line, 15 seconds goes, sprint again, 30 seconds, sprint again, 45, and so on until they get 7. And that one's, you know, we've, like myself and the supervisor that I have for my master's degree, we're actually going to, hopefully in the next month or so, we'll publish a paper on the protocol for it. He's obviously, he's doing most of the legwork on that in terms of writing research papers. I'm not that well versed in that quite yet, even though I did do a bit of it in my master's, but yeah, that's something that we've found pretty valuable as well in terms of just repeated sprint ability on the ice. Again, something that's obviously very important for a hockey player. And we basically changed that from a previous test that we were doing, one that's called a RIOT, repeated high intensity endurance test. So if anybody's ever done that test on their own as a player, or has, you know, implemented that test, they'll know that it's like absolutely terrible. Like you're talking about, you're going to have guys puking over the bench and things like that. So it's a similar concept in that they have 6 sprints repeated every 30 seconds, but basically the distance is like all the way down the ice and back, and they have to leave every 30 seconds. And the idea is that you're supposed to hit it as hard as you possibly can every single time. So it's like physically and mentally exhausting for the athlete. And we found that no matter how you explain to it, there was pacing strategies that would happen. Right. So, you know, there are guys that would start pacing themselves kind of in the middle of the test, and maybe they'd pick it back up at the end, where, you know, if that's happening, the data is not going to really tell you much, where, you know, a blue line to blue line 7 times, that's a lot easier for a player to wrap their head around and kind of push it as hard as they possibly can. And what we found with that one, or what we have found with the times that we've done it, is that their total time, so adding up the time of all 7 sprints, is probably the best indicator of their repeated sprint ability, right? So that's something like you can look at a fatigue index, you know, which is giving you a percentage score. That's something that a lot of people will probably be familiar with off of a Wingate test. You know, with those index scores that you get from this test are much, much higher. in terms of like, you know, the closer to 100%, the better. So it's just, there's not a lot of variability amongst players in that score. So it doesn't seem to tell you as much, but that total time was one that, seemed to really give us some good information. So, you know, the, again, and just like anything, like the more we do it, the more data we collect on it, the better it will inform our decisions. So.
How often do you test players on the ice in some form? And in this coming year, do you plan on doing more of it since you won't have competition?
Yeah, so the plan is this year is to do the kind of initial test right off the start of, you know, I don't even know if we can really call it training camp this year because of the situation, right? Because but either way, when they come in, the plan is to do like a kind of a full bore fitness test on and off the ice. And then my plan is this year is to every 4 weeks, so in that mesocycle that I was talking about, so in that deload week, I want to test both teams in a 30 meter sprint on the ice every fourth week. And again, just, you know, have a little bit of a unique opportunity here to kind of check it with them a bit more often. You know, some of the stuff, like I know Mike Boyle is a huge proponent of the time sprints, right? And he's kind of like talked about that as well, as like, if you have the opportunity to get on the ice and do them, you know, every week, then that's great too. It's, with me, it's like logistically that won't work. Like I just won't be able to get on the ice like once or twice a week with both teams, the kind of thing. So that every fourth week will work a little bit better. And just the biggest reason with that is like where we are here at the U of A is that the gym or the sport performance center is located on our south campus, and then the rink and dressing rooms, everything for the hockey players is on north campus, and they're not really that far apart. So, you know, we have like the transit system here, like the train that actually runs between the two campuses, and they're only like a stop away from each other, but it's still, no matter how you look at it, it still is inconvenient, right? So it would be much nicer if we had, you know, our training facilities right with the rink, but obviously not really a reality for us. So in terms of getting on the ice and doing some of the measurements, sometimes logistically it is challenging, but I'm definitely going to do my best to make it work this upcoming season and kind of try to get those numbers once a month. And then what we do in a normal situation is we'll usually do like that big, like pre-post season test, you know, definitely for their off ice stuff. And like over the, you know, we just recently started implementing that kind of full on ice testing battery. So, you know, the hopes is to kind of do that twice a year with the full bore as well, but definitely checking in with the 30 meter sprint once a month moving forward is what the plan is.
Yeah. I like that a lot. I think you hit it perfectly. Like if logistically you can test once a week, something quick, then you're just going to have more data points. And then also becomes almost a bit of a training stimulus to get like a full speed sprint in for the athletes. So, but yes, on the ice logistically becomes a lot harder than off the ice for sure.
Yeah. And, you know, and then, you know, with, I'm imagining it's going to be the same with most people's situations with the coaching staffs that they're dealing with, is like coaches are going to hold that ice time pretty close to their chest. Right. And it's totally understandable, right? It's like, whatever you're looking at, if you're working with like a minor hockey team or anything, it's like, ice time's expensive, right? Like, you know, you're paying upwards of $200 an hour for it. And, you know, it's obviously going to be a little bit different in university settings when you have your own facilities, but either way, it's like that's the coach's time. And, you know, if you definitely need to convince them of the value of it, if you want to be taking up some of that precious time. So.
Yeah. And if you're in the private sector, then I would encourage, I have my clients, I make them do it every now and then on the ice. So just make them go to a stick and puck and spend the $6 or whatever. And I know like kids will be playing pickup games and they'll be like, who's this loser timing his sprints? But I mean, if you want to get better, those are the kind of things you have to do.
Definitely. Yeah. Or even get on an ODR if you need to, right? You might have a little wind resistance or maybe even wind at your back there, but you know, you can always make it work.
Yeah. That'd be fun too. I want to end with a little offhand comment there, is that you teach strength conditioning at the University of Alberta as well.
Yeah. So it's another thing where, you know, it's unfortunate because, I won't be this semester because like my contract's kind of changed with the recent COVID stuff, and I've kind of got cut back in terms of my hours. But, for the last 4 years, I would say that I've taught it in some capacity. So the last two semesters, it was myself and two other coaches that I work with basically took it on together, and we each of us lectured for a third of the semester. And we each had an assignment that we had to, you know, put out to the class and grade and everything like that. So, but yeah, you know, it's been a good experience. And, you know, just in terms of, you know, having to check in and relearn, but kind of, you know, pick up some of the more basic stuff that you might have forgotten or you haven't looked at in a while. And, you know, the lecturing part of it was hands down my favorite. Like I really enjoyed it. The, marking assignments, you know, I could definitely go without that, but yeah, it was a good experience. And, you know, moving forward, myself and the other coaches will still be involved with in a guest lecture capacity. So that's perfect for me, right? Like, you know, the lecture was what I enjoyed the most. So, but yeah, that is kind of a nice part of being at a university is that, you know, not just for that class, but I do get the opportunity to kind of guest lecture in other kind of, you know, 100 level 200 courses for that are in the kind of kinesiology faculty. So, there's definitely a lot of opportunity to kind of get out there and share some knowledge.
Yeah, it's super cool. And like you said, like you don't truly know something unless you can teach it to other people. So I'm sure it's been like a cool learning experience.
Definitely. Definitely.
Thanks a lot for doing this, Joel. I definitely would like to do more stuff. Maybe do like another podcast or an article or something about competitive thread and talk more about the on-ice speed testing. You know, people are going to be in a lot of different situations. Maybe this is the year that you can add some on-ice speed testing stuff to your programs if you're not going to be playing games, kind of like what you are.
Yeah, 100%, David. Yeah, I definitely love to kind of continue to contribute to the site and, you know, keep helping you with the good thing you got going on here. So,
thanks. Once again, I really appreciate it. Thanks for coming on. And we'll have to geek out about some email music another day as well.
Definitely, man. I really appreciate it. And keep up the good work, man.
Thanks. All right. See ya. Thank you, everybody, so much for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. You can head on over to hockeystrengthandconditioning.com right now where you can read the full transcript of this episode and see all the links, everything we've talked about, including Joel's company, Competitive Thread, and to the Fit Fatigue article that Joel mentioned. Thank you once again and have a great day.